I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, how do you know when your inner voice is telling you some great and profound truth or when it's leading you down the wrong path? We explore O Magazine's new issue. It's all about the power of intuition. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, what a difference a weekend makes. President Obama and the Republican and Democratic leaders in Congress have agreed in principle to a deal that would end the crisis over the debt ceiling. The plan would slice nearly $1 trillion from the deficit and allow the nation's borrowing limit to increase by at least $2.1 trillion, enough to keep the government operating past the 2012 elections. Some Democrats are complaining that the president gave away too much, but the president says he's happy to have a deal at all.
Now, this process has been messy. It's taken far too long. I've been concerned about the impact that it has had on business confidence and consumer confidence and the economy as a whole over the last month. Nevertheless, ultimately, the leaders of both parties have found their way toward compromise, and I want to thank them for that.
The Senate's Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, struck a similar tone in remarks yesterday.
I think I can say with a high degree of confidence that there is now a framework to review that will ensure significant cuts in Washington spending. And we can assure the American people tonight that the United States of America will not, for the first time in our history, default on its obligations.
Joining us to talk about the compromise is Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart. He's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome. Thank you for
Thank
coming.
Thank you very much.
Also with us once again, former presidential speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush and columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report, Mary Kate Carey. She's back with us also here in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So Mary Kate, I'm going to ask you to set the table here. Could you just briefly tell us what's in the framework? And since you're both columnists, I'm going to ask each of you, would you sign it?
The answer, I think, is yes, I would sign it. We're at this point 24 hours away from default, and I think the time is right to end this. The general framework is spending cuts, no taxes included at all, and an agreement to extend the debt ceiling through the election, which was Obama's main thing that he wanted, so that's what he won. And then there will be a bipartisan commission set up, yet another bipartisan commission of 12 men and women from the House and Senate to come up with further spending cuts with a trigger enforcement mechanism attached to that. Correct me if I've got any of this wrong, Jonathan.
So far, so good.
Okay. It changed so much, you know, over the weekend.
Right.
And the triggering enforcement mechanism would include either drastic cuts to non-defense spending or drastic cuts to defense spending that could each party would not want, so therefore they would have to compromise on the spending cuts together.
So they're going to present a package, and it's one of those packages where you have to vote up or down on the whole thing. Is that
correct?
Is that the argument? And that's
yes.
How the cuts actually happen.
Right.
And you say it's an answer, but not a solution, really.
Yeah, my feeling is it's a deal, and it got us over the finish line here, but it's not a solution in the long run. It still does not truly rein in the rate of growth for the government. The government's going to continue to expand. These are not true cuts. These are slowing the rate of growth of the government. There will still be, I think, $7.5 trillion new spending over the mm-hmm. next 10 years. So the government's going to continue to expand, and I think most Americans are not sure of that.
Well,
like, I don't
right.
think that's what
well,
we need
I don't know
to be
about
doing.
That. Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. Well, that's why there are two people in this conversation
right, right.
about like what most Americans think we should be doing. Jonathan, your thoughts about this, and would you encourage members to those who
right.
are interested in your take on this? Would you say agree or not agree?
Look, I think that Congress needs to vote for this. The president needs to sign it, and we need to move on. We are, as Mary Kate said, we are a day away from default. For the first time in American history, the full faith and credit of the United States is now in question, which was something that was unimaginable 6 months ago. The key thing for me in all of this has been this needs to get beyond the 2012 elections, not because it would help President Obama, but because it would help the country. Could you imagine having this ugly fight we just went through in the middle of a presidential campaign, you wouldn't be able to separate the substance from the political. I think that the president won this is enough for me to say, go ahead and vote for it and sign it. Am I happy with everything that's in it? Absolutely not. But that's the nature of governing. You don't get everything that you want. It's about compromise.
Let's talk about those who are not happy with this. I mean, the progressives are furious, getting, you know, furious emails from progressive, you know, writers, bloggers. The Congressional Black Caucus had a phrase. What was it?
Oh, I love it. It is. They called the deal a sugar-coated Satan sandwich.
A sugar-coated Satan sandwich. And why do they think that? I mean, on the plus side of the deal, apparently, it doesn't touch Medicare beneficiaries. Medicare being the program that pays for health care for seniors and some disabled. Social Security, it doesn't touch Social Security. It doesn't even touch food stamps, which was something that was on the chopping block for some. So why are progressives as furious as they are?
They're furious because there are no revenues. There are no tax increases. And that's just something the president, I think, decided that's a fight for another day. The thing that people need to keep in mind, that this is not the be-all and end-all. Once this is voted on and the president signs it, the fights aren't over.
It's only the beginning.
It's only the beginning. Yeah. The fights will continue.
But is the fight over revenue over?
Oh, absolutely not. Remember, the Bush tax cuts expired December 2012. We are going to have this discussion again. And I actually think that because the president bent over backwards to meet the Republicans more than halfway, he has set himself up, I think, on a very sort of strong foundation to make the case for why those Bush tax cuts for the upper income should be allowed to expire.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Of course, we're talking about the compromise that both sides hope will end the debt ceiling crisis. Our guests are Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. That's who you just heard. Mary Kate Carey of U.S. News and World Report. Mary Kate, despite the fact that the view from the side of the progressives or the center left is that the president bent way over backwards and has been doing so throughout these negotiations, there's still, as I understand it, some people on the right who are saying it doesn't go far enough.
Right. There were Michelle Bachmann, for example, came out against it. And this morning, Connie Mack, the senator from Florida, said he would not be supporting it.
Mitt Romney, finally.
Well, Mitt
finally.
Romney and Michelle Bachmann are running for president, so
right. That's
that. But Connie Mack, tell us why him, and particularly given that he represents Florida, where there are a lot of people who rely on these programs like Medicare and Social Security.
He had two points in the interview I heard. One was he doesn't think this really solves the crisis, as we were talking earlier. It solves the debt ceiling crisis. It doesn't solve the debt crisis. And by 2020, we will still be at $20 trillion in debt. And he thinks there needs to be a stronger package of not just slowing the rate of growth, but cutting back. Second of all, he had questions about this 12-person commission and exactly who those people are going to be and what they're tasked with. On paper, I believe entitlement reform and tax reform are part of their job, but he's still a little anxious about what that all means and whether they really have any teeth.
Well, what about the defense spending side of it? That is also one of the other big elements.
Mm-hmm.
Is defense spending on the table at all? In fact, I have to tell you that we're getting a lot of listeners writing in on Facebook and have been writing in all night and all morning talking about this. One listener writes that she wonders if the military cuts. She says, I can't seem to get any straight answers on any news station. All I heard was military cuts. Hopefully that just means cut non-essential employees that play solitaire all day at the Pentagon and give some contractors the boot on non-essential work practices. And what gives you the flavor of but what about that? Is defense spending still part of this conversation?
Yes, I believe it is. As of the last version, I thought, well, Jonathan's actually read the bill.
Well, I've read the bill very, very quickly, all 74 pages of it. Look, they're still going to have to talk about this bill in the conferences. They still have to figure out whether there are things that need to be tweaked or modified or what have you. And when this super committee gets put together and they start focusing on other cuts, yes, everything is on the table. And you know what? Everything has to be on the table. People keep talking about kicking the can down the road. We've run out of road. And so if there's one silver lining in this whole ugly affair, it's that the conversation has now changed to what can we do to change the fiscal trajectory of the country for the better.
Well, final thought from you, Jonathan. So that's the point that President Obama made last week and in his conversation with us here at NPR and, of course, in interviews he's been having along. What his argument is to his base is these are things that we'd need to do anyway. Even if we controlled every branch of government, these are things we'd have to do anyway. How then does he go back to his base and say, but we didn't address, you know, the fact that hedge fund managers have an upper tax rate that mm-hmm. is less than a high school principal or a police chief? You know, how does he go back and defend
that? He goes back and he says, this isn't the end. This is the beginning. We have a lot of serious decisions that have to be made. We're coming back at the Bush tax cuts in December 2012. And you know what? Hang with me. I'm going to need your help.
And Mary Kate, how do the Republicans address the fact that even though the polls show that voters are mad at everybody, they are more angry at Republicans who see particularly the fiscal conservatives or the Tea Party, who they view voters on the whole, and independents are obviously particularly important here, who they view as being obstructionist and in some ways unreasonable. How do the Republicans address that?
Well, say what you want about the Tea Partiers, but they did get the president to go from a clean vote to no taxes, entitlement reform, tax reform, all this stuff that's on the table now. And they were only one half of one branch of government. They accomplished a tremendous amount, and they said they were going to do it, and they did it. And you might not have liked the process and how messy it was, but the Tea Partiers did deliver. And I think that
so their argument's going to be, we changed the conversation from spending to cutting.
Most Americans now understand exactly how big the problem is and exactly what crisis we're facing and what needs to be done. And you got to give a lot of credit for that. 6 months ago, I don't think most Americans understood the consequences of what was going on.
Mary Kate Carey writes for U.S. News and World Report. She's also a former White House speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. Jonathan Capehart is a columnist and editorial writer for The Washington Post. They are both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Fast food chains often tweak their menus to appeal to local palates. The Frenchification of America's most famous burger chain has been immortalized in this scene starring John Travolta and Samuel Jackson from the 1994 film Pulp Fiction.
You know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
What do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
Forget Royale with cheese. McDonald's is really adding some new cuisine to its menus in France, which is why our last word in business this morning is McBaguette. McDonald's will soon offer fresh breakfast baguettes in its McCafés across France, along with locally made artisanal jams. The French are already big consumers of McDonald's fare, but when it comes to lunch, burger sales still pale in comparison to the sales of traditional baguette sandwiches. So the next new addition to the McDonald's French menu, sandwiches on crusty French bread. And that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
C'est la vie, c'est the old folks. It goes to show you never can tell. They furnished off an apartment with a two-room.
Finally, I was trying to keep track of the negotiations over raising the debt ceiling this weekend, and all of a sudden it reminded me of an incident I had had in a parking garage near my house last year sometime. It was late summer or spring, and it was hot. I had the kids with me, and we were finished doing whatever it was that we were doing, and we were ready to go home, so we jumped into the car and tried to head out, but we could not. It turns out that a lot of other people were trying to leave at the same time, and we were parked on the third of seven levels, and no one, I mean no one, would let us into the exit lane. When I tried inching the car forward, they'd close ranks. I tried to make eye contact with several of the drivers. They made a point of looking away, some with this kind of smug, triumphant look, others just pretending they didn't see us. As the other cars were backing up behind me, honking and waving, I made what I think is the universal gesture of resignation, shrugging, palms up. Still nothing. Finally, a lady who was stuck behind me walked up to see what was going on. And when I told her, we decided to walk up to some of the cars together. And we said, look, you have to let us out. Take turns. That's how it works. You know, turns. One guy, an older guy, kind of drew himself up and shouted at us in this self-righteous voice, wait your turn. And then shut his window with a harumph. Wait your turn? Wait until every car that just happened to be parked on a higher floor above us exited? Really? Who made up that rule? My new friend and I just looked at each other like, what just happened? Have these people all lost their minds at once? And just in case your mind goes there, it was not a racial thing. The obstructionists, I really want to say jerks, but I'll say obstructionists, were both black and white and whoever else lives around here. And it was not a gender thing. They were both men and women, and some had kids in the car like I did, and some didn't, and they were all ages. The closest explanation I could come up with is that some kind of collective jerkiness had taken hold of all of them on that floor, and they all just decided that they were right and everybody else was wrong, and nobody was going to get out of that garage before they did. I bet you can see where I'm going with this. How does it happen that in the same country where citizens cried together on 9/11 a decade ago, who dropped everything they were doing or worked double shifts to give comfort and aid to survivors of Hurricane Katrina more than 5 years ago, couldn't get it together to agree on a spending plan before bringing the economy to the brink of disaster? Yes, I know, natural disasters are different. People figure it's nobody's fault, so you have to help. Being attacked is different. A common enemy brings people together. But what I wonder is, what is it that makes us behave the other way and put our common decency and respect for other people aside? What is it that causes people to just know that whatever it is that they want in the moment has to take precedence over everything and everybody else? I'm sure somebody's going to write a book about what's been going on in Washington these last few weeks and months. Maybe it'll be one of those Bob Woodward books where he tells you what people were thinking when they were alone. I hope all the key players will participate, and I hope they will all be honest so we can understand what it is that made them think that whatever it is that they want, that the people who voted for them or gave them campaign money and only them have legitimacy in these discussions that affect all of us. Back to the garage. My new friend and I conferred with the other drivers who were stuck with us. We got back in our cars. We summoned our inner jerks and started leaning on our horns. All of us. Finally, some young guy waved me in, so I waved my friend in, and on every floor after that, we waved at least one car in each. I don't know that we changed anything, but at least we got out of that garage. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
And for more on the deal to avoid a government default, we're joined now by NPR's Cokie Roberts, who's with us most Mondays. Good morning.
Hi, Renee. Welcome back.
Thank you. Is there any danger here that the more the White House tries to sell this deal, the more Republicans resist?
Well, both sides have that problem, and each side's trying to convince its own members that they won while telling the other side they made big concessions. But look, there are people on both sides here who will not go along with this deal. That's why the leaders are spending today counting votes, trying to make sure there are enough members of their caucuses to go along to try for once in this Congress to find a center. But it's not easy, Renee. The fact is there is not a center in this Congress, so you have to create it anew on every vote.
Well, obviously, as members make a decision about whether to support this measure, they're considering the politics as well as the policy. So how do conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats, both ends not getting probably everything they want or even a lot of what they think they want, how do they end up playing this?
Well, they don't like it, and I would suspect that in both cases, in the extremes, that they will vote against it. But it is interesting that both conservatives and liberals hate it. But you know, look, the leaders, and partly as a response, as David Plouffe just said, to voter frustration, have decided that it's bad politics and as well as bad policy not to act. But the extremes are often from districts where their only danger is a primary challenge. And so the leaders have essentially decided that in this Congress, we really can't make big decisions about such things as entitlement reform and tax reform. And so that's why they've created this super committee of Congress to come up with those decisions later this year. And yesterday, a couple of times, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said that it was like the military base closing commission, which puts all the military bases proposed for shutdown in one package. Congress then has the option of voting up or down on that package, but they can't protect individual bases. That's what's planned for this super committee of 12 House and Senate members to deal with the deficit. It's somewhat stunning because it says that Congress will not deal with its basic spending and taxing jobs, but it's also pretty smart because it is a way to get around these serious problems.
Well, just ever so briefly, Cokie, some newcomers to Congress, and we're mostly thinking Tea Party here, promised to change the way business is done in Washington. Well, have they?
Yes, they've focused on cutting rather than spending. They don't compromise, and so they force the hand of the other side.
Cokie, thanks very much. That's NPR's Cokie Roberts.